The local hire. The local hire for the Conjuring. Wait, why weren't you in The Conjuring? Why weren't you in The Conjuring?
Because I wasn't living there. I think when they when did they film that? That was, I want to say I was in
2013.
When they were.
I think yes. Or maybe 2015. I don't remember. You were not in college in 20. Oh,
yes,
wait,
we were. We were sophomores, baby.
Maybe you were. I was.
Yeah, there are a bunch of locals in that movie. Oh my god!
No way.
The girl that played Gypsy Rose was in it. I haven't seen it ever.
Oh really? You haven't?
Uh-uh.
It's spooky. It's scary. Very scary.
It's spooky, baby.
Yeah. The strangeness of the story. Just to give you a recap, if you haven't listened to it, what's so weird about it is the family that moved in that experienced the haunt in the 70s. What kind of incited the whole thing was that they had a dog named. God, now I'm forgetting the name. It was like some weird name like Bathsandra, a weird name for a dog. The dog was hit by a car and eventually something drew them to move and they ended up moving to the Arnold Estate. All of these strange sightings and experiences were happening. The mother dug into the history of the home. There was a woman who lived there who the rumor goes that she killed her children and she was involved in witchcraft. Mm. Her name was Bathsandra. How
now what in the world?
Weird.
How would they have named their dog that? Now, hold on. How would they have named their dog that?
It was
just randomly.
There was some like no, there was some story behind it. They had read the name in like a book or something, the kids, and the dog had like a weird personality, so they thought it would be cute to give her a weird name. Almost like when people name like a dog like a people name, like have you ever met a dog that's named Jennifer? A dog that's named like
yeah
like I don't want to meet a dog named yeah like Richard. This is my dog Richard. Yeah.
Okay, well that's dark. If I meet a dog named Richard, I'm walking the other direction. I don't care how cute it is.
But isn't that scary though?
Yeah, that is very scary.
I'm definitely mispronouncing the name. It's some other version of that name. But the reason she was rumored to be a witch was one, she had three children, all of which who died in her care. Which, you know, early 1800s when she was alive could have been fine, could have happened naturally, is my point. But she then took care of the neighbor's baby, which was an infant for a little bit. That baby died in her care. When the baby was returned and being prepared for a funeral, they found, sorry for anybody who's listening who can't handle this kind of conversation. Maybe I'll cut this out, maybe not. But they found a needle prick, like in its skull. Basically, she had put a sewing needle through its head very, very like delicately to leave almost no mark. And she was accused of harming this child. And then the rumor goes that she hung herself from a tree in the yard before cursing the town and the home, which I think is what they depict in the movie. Like that's the lore.
Yeah.
Because they show that tree. They show the noose on the tree.
Cover. Yeah.
Yeah. So that now you know the story.
And doesn't it tie to the same people as like Amityville or something? The same like paranormal experts?
Yeah. No? Ed and Lorraine Warren. They worked on the case. Yes. And I think Lorraine Warren, before she died, she said later in her years that because they named it the Conjuring House. She said her experiences there were among the most terrifying in her entire career.
Wait. Okay. When we went to Zach Bagans, mm-hmm. Was that the Conjuring? Like it was like a rocking chair or something. Do you remember this?
I do remember that. I don't know if that was from the Conjuring House. Maybe
I feel like it was Ed and Lorraine Warren.
They worked on so many cases. It's like impossible. Like
they
did the Annabelle case.
They did it.
Yeah. I don't even know if they worked on. I was also joking with Scott because who they got to play them in the Conjuring, Vera and Patrick Wilson, the hottest actors known to man.
Like, of course. Like, was this before Insidious or after?
I don't remember, actually. Patrick Wilson just kind of like ate that up, didn't he? He was like, I'm going to be in all the horror movies. But I don't remember which came first, but I just know Patrick Wilson and Vera are just so painfully Hollywood attractive to be playing Ed and Lorraine Warren, the equivalent of two paranormal pilgrims. Like, they're dressed like pilgrims and they're movie stars. It's so ridiculous.
Baby, who would play us?
God willing, Liza would take my role. As is, no costume change, same makeup, everything's the same.
I don't think we have the budget for Liza. I think it's going to have to be Lisa Rinna.
And she'll take that job. She'll take that job.
She would.
Absolutely. She's looking for it. So Lisa Rinna's playing me. Who's playing you?
Like a QVC host.
So one of Lisa's friends that she's bucketing.
One of the women that she does the Today Special Value with. They jump straight from that to the movie making of Creep Time.
Lifetime. If you're listening, we're available for a meeting. That's who's going to be producing it. Also, I was going to ask you, how was your trip? How was your birthday?
Oh my gosh, it was so fun. I really need to take you skiing someday. I know that, like, it terrifies you on some level, but with the amount of, like, because I know you love, to a certain degree, like, natural beauty and nature and getting outdoors, and, like, skiing is just, like,
I do, yeah.
Oh my God, there's no feeling when you get to the top of a mountain and you go down. If you really, once you get pretty good and it's not terrifying anymore, it's just like the most amazing feeling. And taking in nature like that is just, oh, it was amazing. I had the best time.
I will say, all the pictures and the videos that you shared with me looked really beautiful, but I couldn't get it out of my head with all the messages and all the creepers who contributed to Stu's card. Thank you so much, because that was so, so special. But I couldn't stop laughing at the idea of you reading that while you're soaring down a mountain. Because I know that's what's happening.
1000%. Also, the fact that I was literally, I opened that message, I'm like reading all the messages. First of all, creepers, I love you guys so much. Those were some of the sweetest, also funniest messages I've ever read. But like reading those, getting choked up and like laughing to myself because I was skiing solo. So I'd be at like the top of the mountain reading it. And then I'm like starting to like fog up my glasses, like my, or not glasses, my goggles. And I'm like, okay, I'll probably read these. Right. I'll read this card and then I'll break both of my legs going down. But it would be worth it. It would be worth it.
God, I couldn't get that image out of my head. That was so funny. But I'm so,
that was so
happy
funny.
That you loved it. Oh my God. I'm so happy that your birthday was so special.
It was so special. But I mean, that seriously was so, that was so special. And like, you're just the best friend for putting that together. That was like the sweetest thing ever.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. It made me so happy to know that you received that on your trip and you were having a great weekend. So here I am midweek to dismantle all of it with the most sinister of cases.
And baby, my ass is already sore from skiing. So,
oh, I wrote in my notes somewhere in here. I have a question listed. It goes, how is the ass? Ask Stu how the ass is doing. So
not well, bitch.
Not well, bitch. This is something, I think this was requested in Reddit. I'm not entirely sure how I came about this. Maybe I listed it here. Oh, yeah. I found it on Facebook, actually. So I was in search of something that I didn't have any prior knowledge on. I really wanted like a fresh case, something that I hadn't read too much on, and I could like sink my teeth into the research today. And I think this, like I said, might have been suggested by other creepers. It is the mystery and the absolutely horrifying story of what happened to Angela Hammond. Do you know that name at all?
I don't.
It's Angela, I don't think it's Hammond. Very commonly discussed, actually. I mean, I'd never heard of it. I haven't heard of it in the true crime world or the disappearance world. It was just kind of on the back burner, I've seen on a lot of other podcasts. So I would normally give a top line of these circumstances and like clue you into what we're going to be getting into, but this is going to be a different story. I'm going to have to make everybody go in blind to this, and I'm going to have to tell it like a story, unfortunately. So it's going to be moment by moment what happened to her.
Oh, I'm excited. Oh, I can't say that.
That's I mean, you're excited for the storytelling.
I'm excited
you're
for
not
the,
excited
for the storytelling.
For the tragedy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. One more time and I will get canceled.
No, 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 baby. I protect you. You have divine protection. There is no cancellation. The only thing getting canceled is my YouTube TV subscription.
Oh, well,
I got one for the Oscars and I was like, canceling it. YouTube TV is such a sham. I'm sorry. It's a sham.
It's pricey.
It's cable. I don't need all that.
Yeah. See, I do.
What do you have a subscription to Peacock? Is that how you're watching Housewives?
I do. But it's just a weird thing. There's something about cable that I just, maybe it's like the comfort of it as like a kid in me that just like flipping through the channels or something. I don't know. I know that sounds so silly, but sometimes I just don't know what I need. I might need Turner Classic Movies. I might need AMC.
I never have that experience. I am done with, because cable to me is crap. It's just like,
yeah.
2 years from now, we're on cable and we're plugging a show on cable. Mark my words, y'all. But
I'm like, I guess I'll. How are we going to get on QVC?
I guess I'll move on for now. But before we jump into it, I just want to say welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Creep Time, the podcast. We are your hosts, Silas, Dean, and Sue. We are so happy to be back for another episode this week. And thank you to everybody who recently signed up for premium and listened to the Conjuring episode that I was talking about that we came out with yesterday or whenever we're filming this or recording this, rather. Thank you again to everybody who continues to support the podcast by leaving positive reviews, following, subscribing, sending all of your messages on Reddit. I'm going to have pictures of this case up on Reddit as well. And Stu, don't you worry, baby. I have got pictures for you. I've got links up this time.
And my hands are firmly clasped in my lap. You do not have to worry about me sleuthing, I promise.
Do you want me to send you some pictures now? I'll send you some pictures of Angela. Yeah, let's see. This is before we're actually going to get into it. I think it's good that I send you these now. And then I can jump into the story. But thanks again, everybody, for stopping by. I'm not going to belabor it. We're going to jump right in. Are you ready?
I'm clicking the link, and then I'll tell you I'm not ready, but here we go. Whew.
Well, these are just pictures of Angela. So this is just going to give you a little bit of setup of, like, the subject of, you know, who we're going to discuss, what we're getting into. And this is a Mississippi case. Or no, sorry, Missouri. My bad.
Is this in the 80s?
This is 1991, so basically the 80s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can tell by the hair, though.
Yeah, I'm guessing by the wardrobe and the hair. Oh, she looks youngish. Like, she looks like she might be in high school or something.
Yeah, she was only 20 at the time.
Oh, okay. Very classic 90s, like,
totally
styling, and she looks so happy. Oh, gosh.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready
to get into. So, like I said, I'm going to have to tell this like a story through and through. So we're going to stop in the middle. We'll talk about things, but I'm going to tell you what happened on the night of April 4th, 1991. So this was a quiet Thursday evening. We're going to zero in on our subject here. This is 20-year-old Angela Hammond of Clinton, Missouri. Which part of the state is Clinton, Missouri in? Is that central to Missouri? Do you know?
I have no idea. The only part of Missouri I've ever been to is Columbia. And
you haven't been to Kansas City?
No, I've never been to Kansas City.
Oh, Kansas City's really fun. Kansas City is actually really, really cute. It's beautiful. Let's see. Wait, now I'm second guessing myself. Hold on. I'm confusing myself if I meant Missouri or I meant Mississippi now, because there's a Clinton in both. No, it is Clinton, Missouri.
Okay.
I'm just going to double check and make sure that I'm not misspeaking. Yes. Yes. Clinton, Missouri.
Okay.
Let's look at a map real quick and see where exactly that is in the state.
Okay. Oh, it looks like it's sort of known for being like a very like Victorian sort of like vibe in the downtown.
Interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty small, even in 91. There's a population of less than 9,000 people there. And it's, for anybody who wants to place it in the state, it's up kind of tucked in like the left-hand corner of the city, the upper like western corner of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we're at. Population, about 8,000-9,000 people, considered a small town in 1991. And on this specific evening of April 4th, Angela did a few things that we know. She attended a cookout earlier that day with her fiance at the time, who was 18-year-old Rob Schaefer. It's a couple years younger than her. Now, Angela and Rob had been together since 1990, the year before, and they were described as very affectionate. They're very loving. Rob was considered a strong athlete all through his school setting. And Angela, at just 19, became pregnant with Rob. So at that time, he proposed to her in 1990, and they had plans to really start their lives together as they were to be married. So Angela was already holding down a steady job. She worked a night shift at a local bank. And I was trying to think, like, what that job is. Maybe, I mean, anybody who could shed light on, I don't know, different careers and needs in the 90s, but what bank needs someone to operate something at night unless they're like a custodial worker?
Well, I was going to say, or security. I don't know, maybe if she was like a security guard.
I don't think so. That's not the way it was described. She was kind of described as like, it sounded more like desk work. But again, I couldn't imagine like why someone would work a night shift. But anyway, that was her deal at the local bank. And Rob had plans after school that he was going to join the military, and then he would be able to come home to Angela, right? And he would have some veteran support. So they had their family's blessing. They had support. Everything was kind of looking up at this point, and it felt very normal until this night. Now, don't forget, they're at this cookout, and the cookout kind of comes to a close right around like 9, getting close to 10 p.m. Angela had to drop Rob off at his parents' place because he needed to watch his little brother that night. So he's on babysitting duty, and the plan is he's just going to have to watch his little brother, I think, until his mom gets home. And then once his mom is home, he's going to be relieved and he's going to be able to go out and hang out with Angela. So she then drove to the food barn. Do you know what food barn is? I actually have a picture of this as well. Think of it just like a Piggly Wiggly. It's just a grocery store.
Okay.
Let's see.
I was going to say, was that one of our haunts on tour? But I don't think so.
Food barn? No, I think we would remember if we found a food barn. But I do have this picture, which I think is actually from when they roped off the food barn, like for security purposes, once the situation became a crime scene. So let me send this to you now.
Okay.
I think this will really like place the location and the vibe of like what this setup is like.
Wow, what a photograph. That's a very visually interesting photograph. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, creepers, I'm going to have this up on Reddit as well. So all of the pictures that we discuss, you are going to be able to see. So, like I said, she dropped off Rob. She goes out to the food barn. She stops in the parking lot, leaves her car there, and she met up with her girlfriend. And the two of them just kind of drive around for a bit. Basically, they're like waiting out for Rob to be relieved, right? So they're driving around for a couple of hours. They cruised in the car. It was very chill. And they're just kind of going down these dark, winding roads in Clinton, Missouri. There's really nothing going on. Angela feels the tiredness of the night because it's getting close to like 11 o'clock at night, and she doesn't really want to hang out with Rob this late. So don't forget, she's 4 months pregnant. She's exhausted. She decides, you know what, instead of just cruising around, how about you drop me back off at my car? She says to the girlfriend, I'm going to go to a payphone. I'm going to call Rob, let him know that I really don't want to hang out tonight. I'd rather just go to bed. So that's what happens. She gets dropped off back at the food barn. She gets out, goes to her car, grabs a couple of quarters, some money. She goes to the payphone. Don't forget, 1991. Now, an interesting detail is that Angela didn't have a home phone, which I thought was strange, but because she didn't have a home phone, she couldn't afford the line. She was pretty well-versed in having to leave her home to walk out at night to make calls at a payphone, because I think anybody who was like left alone, especially a young woman, to be out in the middle of the night at a payphone would seem strange or alarming, but she was pretty secure with this. I think in addition to her working a night job made her feel secure at night. So she's just hanging out at this payphone, right? She made a call at exactly 11:15 p.m. Now, Rob, he is super understanding. He's like, yeah, it's no big deal. I totally get it. He's like, you know, my mom's home anyway, but I understand if you want to go to bed. They end up staying on the phone for about 15 to 20 minutes, just kind of chatting, and then they're going to call it a night. When about 20 minutes into this call, something very unexpected takes place near the phone booth. What are your immediate thoughts to the setup?
Well, I'm thinking that what you said was very astute, that if she doesn't have a landline of her own, there's a chance that somebody knows she comes to this payphone maybe often. So I was already starting to think that. I was also looking at this photograph of the food barn and just imagining, I mean, it looks like a movie. Like the idea that she's standing out there this late at night on a payphone is so eerie and creepy just looking at the picture.
I think I got a picture of the payphone too. Hold on.
Oh God. I'm really hoping it doesn't go to like, all of a sudden the phone cuts out.
It's not going to be good. I can tell you that.
Okay.
Yeah, this is not a positive scenario that we're setting up, but I know what you mean. I mean, the thought of somebody standing out in the middle of the night trying to make a call on a payphone, the only thing I could think of was Denise Huber when she got that flat tire. And then she had to get out of her car to walk to the emergency phone, which was like only a couple hundred feet. I mean, because arguably, like, I mean, Angela's close to her car. Maybe that's why she felt secure, as her car is parked like right by the payphone. She's just kind of hanging on the phone, like chatting with Rob before she's going to get too tired and be like, okay, babe, I'm going to go home.
I think that's kind of public payphones are always like an eerie concept, I think, in horror movies and movies in general, because it's like, no, you're totally out in the open, or you're like in one of those clear boxes, but like you're not focused on your surroundings. Yeah. And like anybody can see you. And I don't know, that whole setup is already just like giving me the creeps.
Oh God. I remember this story I covered on TikTok a while ago. This is such a sad story. I think this happened in the 70s or the 80s, where there was a girl, and her sisters were playing a prank on her. Her older sisters, they locked her out of their home while their parents were out that night as a prank. And she walked off from the home trying to get to a payphone to call her mom and dad. While she was on the phone with them at the payphone, a man took the phone from her. And he said, if you ever want to see your daughter again, you better get here now. They never found the girl. They never found her.
Oh my God.
Like, when you talk about sinister things going down in a public place or like at a payphone, that's immediately what I think of.
Yeah. Especially at night. Yeah. It makes me think of like all of a sudden the line goes, like it gets cut, or somebody intercepts, or somebody, you hang up the phone and somebody's right there to take you. Like, that's just kind of what I associate, unfortunately, a payphone at night with.
You should brace yourself for the next part of the story. So they're on the phone, right? And it's about 20 minutes that, like I said, that went by, and they're in the middle of the conversation. Angela interrupts Rob and she goes, Rob, there's something weird going on out here. There's a truck that I'm watching and it keeps circling the block. And he's immediately weary. And he's like, okay, can you tell me what you're seeing? Like, what kind of truck is it? She said, it's some kind of like older model Ford and it's green. It's like a green pickup truck. But while she's describing it, all of a sudden the truck pulls up directly in front of like the phone area. Like, it's right by the payphone. And I don't think it's shown in the picture that I sent you, but there is another payphone that's right next to it. They're like kind of stacked. You know how you would see like groups of payphones?
Mm-hmm.
So people can make multiple calls, right? So this truck pulls up in front of the payphone area and a man gets out and he starts to approach. She is completely aware, but she's not immediately assuming that she's in danger. But she does go on to describe the guy over the phone to Rob. She said, there's a guy getting out. And he's like, okay, what does he look like? And she says, he's like, I don't know, like 20s or 30s. She said, he's really dirty looking, really dirty, which I thought was strange. He's a white guy, kind of tall. He has a mustache and glasses, and he's wearing overalls. Really specific in my mind. Now, like I said, the phone booth that she's using, it's next to another payphone. So this guy who approached her, he makes his way to the other booth and he seemingly starts to make a phone call, like very quietly. And he's kind of like looking back and forth at her. He's talking on the phone. And then he's looking back at his truck. He hangs up the phone and he walks back to his truck. And then he's searching in his truck for something with a flashlight. She's describing all of this in real time over the phone to Rob. So Angela's kind of freaking out. And don't forget, she's like keeping an eye on this guy. She does feel safer with Rob on the phone, but she's aware that like something sketchy feels like it's going on. She then decides to try to defuse the situation. And maybe this was out of nervousness. She calls out to the guy and she goes, "Hey, I'm sorry. Do you need to use this phone?" Thinking that maybe his phone wasn't working, right? And that's like why he's kind of lingering around, like maybe waiting for her to get off the phone. So the man goes, "No, I'll try my call again in a few minutes." So she whispers everything that's happening back to Rob. And he's like, "How about I get in my car and I come down there right now?" Because he's only a few blocks away. And like, he's so close to the food bar. And Angela's like, "No, no, that's insane. Like, you're overreacting. Let's just keep talking. It's fine." She's still kind of keeping that eye. And the guy, like I said, is just lingering by the truck. But she's got her back turned to him for just a little bit. Only a few seconds, according to Rob. Within those seconds, Rob would hear the most haunting thing that he possibly could on the other end of that line. The shrill sound of Angela screaming at the top of her lungs and the loud clang of the phone whacking against the base of the booth.
No.
Now, there is some speculation on this specific detail. I found this in a couple of different reports, but I couldn't fully confirm it. Rob also claimed that he heard a man's voice in the background say, "I didn't need the phone anyways," like in the mix of all the screaming. So Rob took no time. He immediately just drops his house phone, gets in his car. He is racing to the food barn because he has no time to even call the police. So while he's flying down the street, he passed another vehicle that's hurtling down the road so fast in the opposite direction. It's the goddamn green truck. To his claim, as it passed him, he could hear Angela screaming, "Robbie," from inside the truck. And he said he could see her through the front windshield, trying to fight somebody in the front seat. So Rob basically throws his car. I know, it's moving so fast, but he throws his car in reverse and immediately he gets on the tail of this truck, which started to head into the backwoods of this area. And it's nothing but sharp turns and winding roads. So he's following the truck because this is like his only chance at saving Angela from this abduction. Like, it's got to be now. He has to keep a tail on this truck, because there's no other way for him to know where she's going. He gets 2 miles into following them into the backwoods when his car's transmission fails. Because that initial reverse, when he like threw his car into reverse, he didn't stop the car to do that and it messed up the transmission. So it was just too abrupt. And by the time he got to the woods, he completely blew the whole thing out. The car is dead. He's stuck in the dark of the middle of the back road and all he sees is this truck peeling off into the darkness, with his fiance trapped inside. That is where we're at.
That image of like passing and she's like screaming in the front seat and you like have to throw it in reverse. That image is like, I don't know about the creepers listening or you, but like I can cinematically like see that in my head right now. I can see this whole thing in my head.
It's horrifying. It's almost like, well, that's kind of what they use against him when he eventually like has to tell this to the police. Everybody's like, "This sounds like a movie, pal. Like, it sounds like you made up a movie script, but this actually happened." That's so scary though. The thought that he was on the other, to be on the other line with somebody and just hear a loved one screaming. Yeah. I can't think of a worse feeling. Like, that is unimaginable to me.
I'm actually amazed that he got there fast enough to make a cross paths with the truck. Like, thank God he actually, unfortunately, it didn't pan out. Like, the transmission blew out, but like, thank God he actually crossed paths. Like, I would be freaking out if I heard that phone go down. And then I was like, well, I either stay on the line or I have to go. Like, you know, it's like,
how do you make that decision?
2 seconds. Yeah.
You're like, do I stay and call the police or do I get in my car? Like, who's to even say that if that car is getting away, like the truck, it's going to be going in that direction anyway, that you're going to run into.
Right.
They could have gone any which way. All he knew was, I have to get to the food barn. He was only like, I think, 7 blocks away. So this would have been minutes, like mere minutes if he was racing in his car where he before he's there.
Wow.
So Rob is basically stranded. He's 2 miles deep into these back roads. And you know what's crazy? I'm going to send this to you too. I also have a picture of the car chase.
Oh my God.
Like, this is a map depiction of like exactly where the payphone was, where the police department was, where Rob's house is, etc. So you'll see how close he actually was. And then eventually where his car stopped in the woods. I'm going to send you a picture of the style of the truck that was allegedly described. Or was described, I should say. Not allegedly.
Oh, wow. So this was just like a straight freaking shot. They were wild goose chasing.
Basically, yeah. I mean, who's to say, like, this guy, whoever took her, really lucked out that his car blew its transmission, because where was he going, you know?
Yeah.
Probably like somewhere normally, where, like, if Rob could have been on his tail.
Right. I feel like in a goose chase, you're normally like zigzagging all over the place, taking turns. Mm-hmm. Like, he was just doing a straight shot flying.
Yeah. Well, I will. Once he gets to the back road areas, there are some very sharp turns, like very sharp, okay. Like winding turns, like once it's to like the area where the transmission blew, which I think is like what caused it to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we're at. You got the picture of the truck too.
Truck. Yeah, I was just going to say creepy truck. Like, what was that movie? I don't know if this truck was in it, but it looks like it would be in it. It's like the old movie. I feel like it was with Saoirse Ronan, like The Bones or something.
The Lovely Bones.
You know what I'm talking about? Lovely Bones. I don't know why this just reminded me of that.
I think it was with Saoirse Ronan, The Bones.
The Bones.
The Lovely Bones.
The Lovely
Bones.
Did
he have a creepy truck in The Lovely Bones?
I feel like, didn't he? I'm not sure, but it just even the vibe of it reminds me of it. It was Stanley Tucci.
There's a suspense scene in there, like a chase scene in Stanley Tucci's character's home, which is one of the most suspenseful I've ever seen in any movie.
Oh my God. Yeah, this is giving me that vibe. I don't know why. 1996 Ford F-Series.
What? That's the one from The Lovely Bones?
Yeah, it's not this exact same truck, but it's a similar like Ford kind of creepy mm-hmm. older Ford.
Yeah, like a 90s Ford model.
Yeah.
That makes total sense. Yeah. I also, you want to know a fun fact about The Lovely Bones? It wasn't originally supposed to be Mark Wahlberg, who played the father. It was supposed to be Ryan Gosling, I think.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And he had, so him and the, either fired or had to leave the project because he had a huge disagreement with the director. He had read the book and he interpreted the father to look a very different way. He put on something like 60 or 70 pounds for the role. And then the director was like, I didn't want this at all. This isn't at all how I saw the character. And this like sparked, I mean, this is all an allegation, but this sparked like a big disagreement, like creative differences about how they saw the story, how they saw the character. And eventually he was booted from the project and they replaced him with Mark.
Oh my God. I don't even think I've ever seen Ryan Gosling like with weight gain for a role.
He That's the thing. I was like, pissed. Wherever that weight was gained, it certainly, I know. Could you imagine like you gain 70 pounds for a movie role and then you get fired from it?
Oh my God.
Talk about the end of the stick.
I'd find a way to be in that movie. I'd be like, this body is getting on camera if it's hell or high water.
I would sue for irreparable damage.
Mm-hmm.
Irreparable damage to my waistline, baby. So here's where we're picking up in the story. Like I said, Rob is stranded out 2 miles into these backwoods and he's panicking. He's got all this adrenaline. I think he was lucky enough to find another passing car that happened to be coming down that road. He flagged them down. They picked him up. Surprisingly, they drive him straight to the local police station. Now, what is insane about this is that when he gets to the cops, he's so worked up and he's so freaked out that they don't even believe the story. They don't buy his story about the abduction. They're like, this sounds like a TV show, kid. That's literally what they say to him. And he's freaking out even more because they're wasting time asking him these like stupid questions, trying to like suss out whether it's for real or he's playing or pulling something. And eventually he's just like, I'll take you to the damn car. Like, I'll show you my car in the woods. I'll take you to her car at Food Barn. So he brought them eventually back to his car, which was there. And then he brought them to Food Barn to show them her car in the parking lot. And that's when it kind of clicks for them. And they're like, okay, this kind of corroborates the story. And like, they do find her belongings in that car. And I was like hearing this part of the story and I'm like, those night shift county bitches, like wasting time.
That's donut patrol.
It's late night donut patrol. Dunkin' that's donuts donut patrol. Hack bitches. That's really what it was, though. I mean, it was just infuriating to read about it. So what I could dig up from the initial intake of the abduction from this point at the Food Barn, their intake was a bit haphazard, surprise, surprise, but they did search her car to inspect for any kind of belongings, anything that was remaining. And what they did find, which I thought was interesting, was her purse. They searched the purse. Everything was there. The only things that were actually taken were her license and her keys, two of which her father believed were kept on her person at all times. She always kept her license in her pocket. So they immediately felt like this was not motivated as a robbery. Whoever wanted her, they did not want money. They wanted her. Mm-hmm. So an initial search at the time of any of the trucks in the public records that could be matching the description of this green Ford, they turned up thousands in the results, which is menacing. Like, how do you even begin to sift through that? Which kind of made me think, I was like, yeah, like if there was a description of like a Prius, like a black Prius in Los Angeles that did something, that's hundreds of thousands of those in this city. I would imagine Missouri at the time would have had a similar problem with older model trucks.
Right. Well, and I feel like Ford trucks out in rural areas, I mean, they're just always going to be more popular. So
it's a dime a dozen. That's the problem, is like, especially specifically this green style truck. There were thousands of them. There was no way to narrow it down. So then we've got the local news. They grab hold of the story. They know everything about the abduction. Hits the town by the morning, and people were basically paralyzed. They were completely in shock. Things like this did not happen in this area. Nobody wanted to leave their homes. And the big question is, where's Angela? Is she even alive at this point? Now, the searches in the case were pretty immediate and very immense. There were a lot of people who came forward in hopes of volunteering or spending their time to help the family through this and try to find Angela wherever she had been taken. These efforts extended to aerial searches. There were woodland searches. There were dog searches, water searches, even farmland searches. Nobody found a sliver of evidence that could point them in any which direction in the hopes of finding Angela. And eventually, with hundreds of people looking and no results, the search efforts eventually tampered down, and it became more and more likely that wherever Angela was, she was most likely dead. So then it kind of teeters into some initial suspicions, because you look to the people who were closest first, right? And arguably, you'd want to look to the people or the person who saw her last, which technically would have been Rob, the fiance. So they looked into him as a suspect, as well as Angela's younger ex-boyfriend, who I think was 17 at the time. I don't exactly know why he was falling under suspicion. They just wanted to look at anybody, like an ex-boyfriend or a current boyfriend, who would have motive to do something so heinous. Both of these boys were interviewed extensively for days. Their stories were completely corroborated, it seemed. They even consented to polygraph tests, both of which they passed. So I think we can mostly rule them out of suspicion. Nothing about them and anything I was reading ever felt like they were to blame. And I don't know if I can ask you this, if you know enough at this point to like say which way or the other, but it would seem backed up to me that Rob is not involved, the fiance.
Right. Because she's pregnant.
Well, I mean, because she's pregnant, but also it's just quite an elaborate story. And it would take a lot of planning to like plant some of the evidence if this didn't go down the way that he described. I mean, we've got a phone record of when the phone call started. We've got her car left in the Food Barn parking lot, and we've got someone who picked him up while he was like trying to flag down a car on the street. Right. Like there's just too many timeline things that would have to align for this to go off perfectly if it was orchestrated by him.
Yeah, I definitely didn't suspect him initially, but when you mentioned there was another boyfriend that was young, I did have mm-hmm. just a little bit of a red flag raised because she is pregnant. And if they had been together,
do you hear this
recently,
going on outside my apartment? Sorry, do you hear this,
baby? Rev, rev, room.
You hear that?
I do. I don't know who that is. Is that a motorcycle? That is.
It could be. It could be a vacuum cleaner. Who knows?
Oh my god! It's the ice cream truck man's now on motor.
He's got to go. He's got to move quick. He's on a Vespa.
He's quick. For a second, I was like, okay, if they're high school, kind of irrational young boys, and like, let's say she had just gotten engaged and was pregnant with him, or mm-hmm. if like there was some sort of discrepancy, like who's the dad, I could mm-hmm. see a scenario where that might be why they would look at the two boys. But it definitely screams more just the initial setup. Somebody saw her outside very late at night and was like, who's that? And creepy, mm-hmm. and it feels opportunistic.
It does, which we've surprisingly looked at a lot of cases that are similar to that scenario, even though we've always talked about how rare it is. But I was trying to piece together, I was like, what was the environment like around her? Because I think when a lot of people hear this story, they kind of imagine her at a payphone in the dark, in the middle of nowhere. This is a payphone that's like right by a parking lot. It's a parking lot that had cars in it. Her car was there. And in fact, there were like three different witnesses who saw her at the payphone at different points. So there were people around, but nobody actually saw the abduction, which I thought was strange.
That is really strange. Because I was imagining that like nobody was out there at this time of night.
No, it was only like 11. Let's think, 20 minutes, probably like 11:30, 11:40. So it's definitely late. It's a Thursday night, but there were still people who were out and about, at least in their cars, like on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, even this guy, Rob, he got picked up on a back road at like 11:40. That was surprising to me. I didn't think anybody would be driving out there at this hour.
Yeah. I guess I was just thinking like rural grocery store in town. That it probably wasn't open at 11:30 or 11:40. So why would people be hanging out in the parking lot is kind of what I was thinking, other than to use the payphone. I mean, that definitely checks out.
Could have been payphone. I wasn't imagining people like out and about at the grocery store, but I can certainly see when like people in a small town kind of congregate at a parking lot space or maybe they're closing up shop, like they're closing up the grocery store and like kind of on cleaning crew and they're like leaving late at night. But it sounded like most of the people who did see her, the witnesses, they were passing by, like driving by. So she was just near a main road, which would make sense for a grocery store.
Right.
So with that said, there are still people who lean into this conspiracy that it was between at least one or two of these boys and that they had somehow conspired to abduct Angela and did something with her. We don't know what. I'm going to put that on the back burner because I don't think that that theory has a lot of credibility, especially with a huge reveal that comes in this case a little later on. But in this investigation, all of the roads kind of came to a halt. Whoever took Angela, they seemed to be an unknown person. There were also these haunting witness statements that I alluded to before that kind of backed up the logical theory that it was an unknown predator and backed up Rob's initial, you know, declaration of what went down that night. These three women who actually saw the exchanges at the payphone, which I think is so unnerving. One of them, I think, was in a car and saw Angela from a distance and she was alone at the payphone. Like there was no truck. Two other women in the same car together, they literally pulled up to the payphone because they mistook her for someone. They thought she was their friend. When they arrived there, they saw that green truck parked outside the payphone, and they remember looking through the windshield at the man, and he ducked down. He ducked down. And then once they realized, they assumed that it was her boyfriend or something, and she like got out for a second to go make a call at the payphone. They didn't think anything was sus, right? Because obviously the truck was so close, like, if she was in danger, she would call out or like try to flag someone down, or she would call 911. She's at a payphone. So they just assumed it was fine. And they drove off once they realized, oh, we don't know her. They very well could have been the last people who ever saw her alive. Those two girls.
Again, it just feels like a weird cinematic moment.
Yeah. It's haunting. It's so chilling to think, I mean, just how fast it all went down too. And that it went down with somebody listening on the other line. That's what I can't get out of my head.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised they just drove off. Like if they already sort of had that weird feeling from when he ducked down into the car to like hide himself, if they weren't like, is the situation good? Like, I mean, maybe that's why they left, because it was creepy, but.
No, it was the opposite. They thought she knew him. That's what I was saying before. They thought she knew him because the truck was so close to her at the payphone. They were like, well, obviously she must know there's a truck behind her and she's making a call. She doesn't seem like she's in distress. So they just thought it was her boyfriend or something. And she like hopped out of his truck to go make a call.
I guess what I was saying is like, if I looked and I saw the guy duck down, when I made eye contact, I would be like, what is going on here? Like, even if I thought that was her boyfriend, I might even think, is this like some weird, like abusive situation? Or like, why is this guy hiding? Why doesn't he want us to see him? Would be my thought. But at the same time, I could see myself being like, I don't want any part of this. I'm getting out of this parking lot.
Totally.
So I don't blame them at all.
I gotcha. I don't know that they drove off because they were creeped out or they suspected something bad was going down. I think if they were freaked out by the guy ducking down, they didn't pay too much mind to it. But they drove off mostly because they were aware, oh, we don't actually know her. She's not our friend. Never thought twice about
it. Got it.
Moved on. So the investigation continues into where she might have gone, you know. And I think eventually they tracked it back to a lead of a couple of different cases that took place in the area. So the police started there. There were a few other abductions that happened within, like, I think 100 miles of this county that softly fit the bill of what happened to Angela. So they wanted to see if there was any connection. These two cases took place, let's see, like I said, actually within 80 miles of Clinton. And both of them were with women who were abducted very late at night. And I think both of them were like closing up shop or something from a night shift. Different women, different counties, totally different scenarios. One woman was found. She was found by a river and she had been sexually assaulted and she was shot dead. No culprit. They couldn't find out who did it. There was another woman who was just completely abducted, totally vanished. She was locking up like from a night shift, like locking up shop. Somebody took her. They never found any evidence of a struggle, no evidence of a robbery in her case. I think the other woman, her place of business, the cash register had been cleared out. So again, it seemed like two different motives were going on there. One was like robbery and then abduction, sexual assault, and murder. The other one clearly was not about a robbery. It was just about abduction. They weren't sure if there was a connection, but they wanted to exhaust all avenues here. So then, with no existing leads, and they've got a reward out for, I think, somewhere between $11,000, it went all the way up to like $16,000 for tips at the time, the police and the family, they just grew desperate. They had no answers, and eventually 6 months would pass. They had no word. So I think at this point, it's tough to say, because we've looked at a lot of cases like this, but it's tough to say, like, when do families start to come to the consensus that we're probably not going to find them? But it sounded like after about 6 months without a word, they started the process of kind of painfully swallowing the grief of knowing that they may not see Angela again. And I think in October of that year, that was the first time her parents left the town. It was the first time they got out of the town since her disappearance.
Oh, God. It must be so tough, too, when you're in a small town like that, where I don't know if you touched on this, but I'm assuming that she grew up there her whole life.
She was born and raised.
Yeah. And probably family has been there a long time. When you're so familiar with a place and you think you know it so well, and it feels like you could find her easily, and yet nothing comes up, that's got to be so just heart wrenching and like deceiving almost.
I think, it was three generations of their family that had been there.
Okay.
So yeah, this really was home. So I think they were just lost in this sense of looking for some kind of closure one way or the other. It was 6 months with virtually nothing to go off of. So her mother talks about this in later interviews, how she felt it was important come October that she take that first step into actually leaving the town. That was kind of a symbol of closure for her, that she was taking a step to start to move on with her life, knowing that she may not get the chance to see her daughter again. Her fiance, Rob, he did end up leaving to join the military like he had always planned. It was his kind of attempt to regain some normalcy, just living with this idea, knowing that come October, you know, all those months down the line, at this point, he would have been a father. And now his fiance and his unborn child are gone with no answers.
How many months pregnant was she? 4 or 5?
Yeah, she was 4 months. 4 months pregnant.
Okay, so she would have been... That's the other really sinister part, is that she would have been showing, and maybe not outwardly, but let's say she gets taken somewhere and is sexually assaulted. I mean,
yeah. I think she even would have told somebody. I think she would have said to her abductor, she would have said, please, I'm pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah.
When we get into a little bit of like the real sinister theory behind this, I don't think it mattered for the intentions of what this person was looking to do. So we would go all the way until December of 1991 without a single word. Nobody has heard anything about the case until something finally comes out of the woodwork. A tip from a man in Canada who claimed to see Angela Hammond. How are we holding up with that?
Canada?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Okay, this is a twist. I fully committed myself to, we were about to find her body somewhere.
Well, no, this is someone who said they saw her very much alive. Do we know if it's true? No. But this is the only like witness statement that really came from anywhere at this point. So this man, he claimed that he saw, because at this point, I mean, the FBI was involved. This was like national news, this case at the time. This man claimed that he saw a young woman who matched the exact picture of Angela Hammond. Like, it was her. This is what he said. He noticed her walking out of a drugstore into a parking lot. Now, you could imagine somebody's panic if they're familiar with the story and they see a woman who looks exactly like this person. And then she got into a green Ford pickup truck. And that truck drove her off. So this should be said, that this is the only witness statement that comes from this parking lot of somebody seeing Angela, right? Canadian police, they worked extensively within the area because it was considered a credible tip. They passed around photos of Angela. There were no other witnesses that could corroborate the event, but this man is dead set. Even to this day, he says, I absolutely saw this girl, but we can take it with a grain of salt. But this is the only witness statement we have to go off of after basically a year.
Well, at least it was a year, not like, because I feel like if it was a witness statement that came, you know, like 5 years later or something, I always kind of lose a little bit of faith in those. But I mean, a year isn't too far off the mark. But of course, how would she have, I mean, would the child have been born? I don't know what I mean? It's like.
Well, there's lots of questions about it. But he said he saw her in the store alone. He said he saw her alone. She walked out of the drugstore. And I think what he described was she got into the passenger seat of the green pickup truck, meaning clearly she was accompanied by someone who was driving her. But that's all he saw. Mm. He also said the back of the truck, I found this strange in the research. He said the back window of the truck had like a mural painted on it. And I don't know what he meant by that, but I first started to think, was it like finger painting or something? Maybe it means nothing, could mean nothing, but it was just the first odd detail that I was like, why would that be a thing? Like, maybe she's being kept in that truck, or they're like living out of that truck, was what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And you start to become accustomed, you start to try to make something a home if that's like the only space that you're allowed to exist in. I don't know.
Or
but something about this
child. Although I guess the child would have been infancy at that point. But
oh yeah, that child would have too young. No finger paint. Yeah. I'm like, baby, I'm still finger painting.
Yeah,
I'm still finger painting, honey.
Yeah. But moreover, a great clue. I mean, if that was real, if that really was her that he saw, I mean, that's an interesting detail that's very unusual and a good signifier that it's a different green Ford than others.
Yeah. I mean, if it's credible, I guess that's the thing. Yeah. We never find out in the end whether or not it was real. But what was beneficial about this witness statement coming within that 1 year territory of the case was that it reignited this fire in her family. They kind of woke up and they were like, we still want to search for answers in this case. And I think they had come to like a silent consensus that it's very likely they may not find Angela alive at this point, but they wanted answers about what happened to her regardless. So her mother continued to do local press. And I think she was even connected with a surviving loved one of the Springfield Three, which is that case we covered of the three women that went missing from that home. Yeah, which is, I think that happened before this case happened. So one of the surviving loved ones reached out to this woman as kind of like, listen, I know the heartbreak and the pain you're going through. I've been through this. I've been through the media circus with it. Like, I understand what you're going through. And she described that she initially got some resistance from this mother. Like, the mother did not want to, like, almost like finding an alliance with this woman would make it real that, like, I'm the same as you. My loved one is missing and most likely gone. But eventually she does come around. They do make an alliance together. And I think they both appeared on Oprah in 1992. And this was all in hopes of bringing more awareness to the case, to these stories. Keep the names alive. Do not forget these missing people. And although this did generate some national attention, there were still no leads in Angela's mystery. Her case had effectively gone cold. We've got no motive. We have no body. And there were all these claims throughout the years, which I won't take a deep dive into because I don't think that they're too credible, but a lot of like prominent psychics came forward at the time to say like, oh, I've spoken to her on the other side. She's buried somewhere on a farm in Missouri. And I think these were taken somewhat seriously at the time because there were a few farms where they did searches with canines because the psychic was saying she's buried on a farm, as is the green pickup truck. The dogs never found anything. So again, another dead end, just a waste of time. The case kind of sat with endless theories until we hit a major break in 2021 that changed absolutely everything about Angela's story. How are you doing?
Oh my God. Before I get into definitely this. Thought you were about to say, and that was it. That's all we know.
Like I said before, we look at a lot of different theories for a lot of unsolved cases. To me, I have never come across a theory that I'm like, I am so confident in it that this could actually be what happened that I'm actually not going to discuss any other theories. I am only going to discuss what came about in 2021.
Okay, game on. I'm ready.
Let me get this picture ready for you because it does involve a letter that was dug up. This case is so far up your alley. It's crazy.
I mean, I really honestly, if they ever made, and I hate to say this like at all, like glamorize this at all, this case, but like made a movie. I mean, it's just so, there's so many elements of it that are so just like cinematic. I know I keep using that word, but like the letter and the being at the payphone late at night, like it's just so, oh God, I feel like, you know, I'm there. Crazy?
I think they did make a movie on it. I mean, maybe I think I saw stills that looked like movie stills and it was showing this story. So maybe it wasn't a movie, but maybe it was like a TV like reenactment. It was a Lifetime movie or something like that. But okay. I think they did they dramatized it for sure. Pretty sure. But baby, I'm about to throw you with this tip that gets uncovered, right?
Okay.
So in 2021, a discovery was made, which came in tandem with an anonymous caller, an anonymous phone call that came in and left a very, very credible tip regarding Angela Hammond and possibly offering the most concrete clue in the entirety of the case. So it was 2021 when the Clinton Police Department put out a statement on her case, which read as follows. This is just a small excerpt from it. there are still several active and open leads being considered. One of those leads originates from the Lake of the Ozarks region. And I thought to myself, I was like, Ozarks? Like Narcoland? Like narcotics land? So
I was just thinking this whole thing reminds me of the Ozarks.
It's when you hear about this, you're going to lose it.
Okay.
So the way this came about is this was traced back to a confidential informant, right? Back in like the 80s, 90s, this guy, I'm assuming it was a guy, he was working for the police. And his sole job was to infiltrate the different drug rings working out in the Ozarks. And he was feeding tips back to the police. So once this informant eventually goes to court and he testified back in the day, his identity was revealed in the court proceedings. And an anonymous letter was received, which was created using magazine cutouts, like one of the like those old ransom letters that you would find.
Right.
It named the informant, it named his ex-wife, and it named his daughter. Coincidentally, his daughter's name was Angela, and she had a striking resemblance to Angela Hammond. This letter was sent on April 4th, 1991, which is the exact same day that Angela Hammond was abducted. And then it would later be connected back to a possible clue in this case that it was intended for the other Angela, this guy's daughter, because she was also living in Clinton at the time. What are the odds of that?
Wait. So back up. So it's not that Angela's family, Angela Hammond, that got abducted. Her family was not at all involved
with
this ring. She was just wrong place, wrong time, or they got a mistaken identity.
Case of mistaken identity. Abducted the wrong Angela from Clinton, thinking it was this informant's daughter. Let me send you a picture of the letter. It's so awful to think about that, if that's really what happened. The confusion.
It's so weird you say this, because I literally started to think Ozark like probably 25 minutes ago as we were talking about this. It's just, there's something about also being out in an area like vast fields and like backwoods and all of that. That's just, it feels so familiar to me. I don't know why. Ozark or maybe Lovely Bones. I know I keep referencing it, but I can just see this. Hello, no.
Oh yeah, wait, do you want me to read the letter?
Yeah, you read it.
So it's a cutout for creepers who can't see this. And again, I'll have it up on Reddit once again. But the letter reads as follows. It goes, and there's a few like blanks in here where it says the person's name, like the informant. So I'm just going to say blank for that. It goes, hello, blank. We know who you are, blank. People like you deserve what you get. We know where your foxy daughter is at. She will see us soon. And then what does it say? I think it says, well, can you read that?
It says,
you
know, tell blank.
Oh, tell blank. And that's his wife that they're referring to. Tell blank. Okay. She has our deepest sympathy in her, what is that word?
Future. I think they were trying to say future loss, but it says
in her future loss. And then it also spells goodbye incorrectly.
Yeah.
So it's clearly a note indicating that they have intentions, because this guy narked on them, to take revenge by capturing his daughter and killing her. That's what they're going to do. They just sussed out the wrong Angela, who looked like this guy's daughter, who lived in Clinton, Missouri. What are the chances of that?
That is so bizarre. I definitely, as you were telling me this, it would have never come to my mind that there would have been some sort of like ring with a ransom.
Never. I mean, she's completely removed. This girl is completely innocent in that. And the confusion she must have felt when she was abducted and asking her abductor, why did you take me? Why me? And they're saying, you're Angela. She's like, I am. But what does that have to do with anything? Like there's no connection there that she, I just wonder if she knew that it was the wrong person.
Yeah.
Before she died. If she died.
I had no idea what was going on. I bet you she might have gotten the sense, because I feel like hitmen or people that are involved in rings, like if she had been the correct girl, they would have known that she was pregnant. And I'm sure that when that guy picked her up and was like, wait, I've never heard about this girl being pregnant? Like, that's the kind of thing.
Why
that,
would
like,
they know she was pregnant?
A ring, I mean, would
she's
know.
Only four, she's only 4 months pregnant. Would they know that?
Well, I would. Well, I'm saying I would think so if I were in a ring and I'm targeting a family. If I'm going to these this extent to say we know where your foxy daughter is, that I have done my research and know that she's also probably, like, I would do my research. And then if I discovered she was pregnant, I would also prey on that fact and be like, well, we're going to get your like pregnant daughter or something. It's a type of thing that's like so sinister and scary to like threaten to someone. And also just, I think that they would have enough intel on this family. They would probably know that she was pregnant if they'd been like hired to stalk the family or put a hit out.
I don't know. I mean, their research must have been pretty haphazard because they got the wrong girl. If this is what really happened, they mixed up who the girl was. So the pregnancy detail seems like that would be an afterthought.
Well, that's
if
what
anything.
I'm saying.
They couldn't.
That's what I'm saying, though, is like they pick this girl up. They pick up Angela, and the guy that picked her up was probably like, wait, this girl's pregnant. Like, did we know that this girl was pregnant? Like the one that we're supposed to be picking up is what I'm saying.
Do you think that maybe they realized too late? Like they were already on the run and then they realized in the truck, we've got the wrong Angela, but it was too late at that point?
That's kind of what I was thinking is that I'm sure they were like, wait, is this the wrong girl? Like, and then
that's insane.
Isn't that weird to think about? I mean, I'm just throwing that out as a theory, but I mean, I really would think, like, if you've ever watched Ozark, granted, it's not in the 90s, it's in a different time period. They know every single detail about the families that they're going after. They would definitely know if the daughter was pregnant. So if they did pick her up and then they, you know, start to go to hurt her or assault her and they see she's pregnant, they probably had a moment where they were like, wait, we don't remember this part. Like, we don't remember this detail. Are we sure we got the right girl? And I'm sure she was going, what is going on? Like, I'm sure she started to realize that she was in a predicament that didn't make sense.
Of course. I mean, that makes complete sense to me. What's strange, but they never went after the real Angela that they were allegedly supposed to abduct because they had, you know, they sent out that ransom note. So the family is already, or not a ransom note, but they sent out that letter. So the informant's family is already on high alert. Like, oh, there are people after my daughter. Kind of thing. So she never gets abducted. It was just this poor girl that took the heat for somebody else's family. And it was probably a case of mistaken identity. And she was just ripped from a payphone.
That is so tragic, like beyond belief, if that's what's happened or what happened.
You know what's haunting about it, though, is that this letter was referenced by that anonymous caller in 2021, meaning there is somebody out there. Somebody who's still most likely alive who knows exactly what happened to this girl because they referenced things in this letter and this letter was not public knowledge. So it had to be somebody who either wrote the letter themselves or they were an integral part of that plan to abduct the original Angela. They've never called back. They have never given any other tips. This was in 2021. And what's kind of devastating about it is that Angela's mother did live to see this break in the case, but she passed away, I think, months after the letter became public. Mm. And I don't know if it ever gave her a sense of closure just to know that it was never about this Angela. It was never about Angela Hammond. It was the wrong Angela, and it was truly a case of wrong place, wrong time, possible mistaken identity. And I will say, although we have this tip and there's really no substantial proof to back it up other than the anonymous caller having private information, I don't think we're any closer to finding a body.
Yeah, that's the craziest part.
Yeah. But until we get another tip from this caller, that is where the case will stand. And for us, it's just a waiting game to see if anyone will ever call back.
That's the type of case that like will haunt Clinton, Missouri forever.
It has too. I mean, people still talk about it to this day. And of course the family was active there. I could send you a picture of her mother before she passed. How scary is that damn letter though?
That's so freaky.
What do the misspellings mean?
Ugh.
What are the misspellings about?
Well, I think the misspellings, it's the same thing as the Zodiac, where you've got somebody that's not super bright on the other side putting together a note.
Could be broken English, maybe. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I don't know. Oh, but I God, really, once I read this theory, I really, really believe this could have been a case of mistaken identity, because there is no other motive outside of that, because they took no money. They didn't want money. They had the sole intention of capturing this girl. And the fact that this letter came, like, was sent on the same day that Angela was abducted, the coincidence of that is just too bizarre for me not to consider that this is really what happened.
Yeah. And also just too small of a, like, targeted area, I feel like, for it not to be something.
Yeah. But Stu, that's all I got. That's all I got for you, baby. Did you expect any of that? Was that a wild story? Or was it?
It's, you know what I was just thinking is that in each case that we cover, mm-hmm. It helps me to, like, relate it back to things like that are in movies or film or, mm-hmm. you know, TV. And I don't think we've really covered a case that's sort of in rural, like, middle of America, Missouri, I guess, other than the three girls that were taken. But I could just, this is such an interesting place and time, and the resources in the 90s, like, weren't, like, clearly we didn't have, like, CCTV footage. Like, it's just an interesting, it's so hard to try to put together anything. So for it to come from this random letter in 2021 is just really mind-boggling.
Yeah, and I wonder, maybe you have a thought on this too. I wonder why somebody after all those years, like 30 years, would decide to come forward and speak about the letter then. Why 2021? Why go out of your way to say, like, by the way, could it have been like a deathbed thing? Like, that's like an anonymous deathbed confession. They never gave any information about the anonymous caller. I think all they said was that it was a man.
Oh, God.
I don't know. But I do have some hope that this case, just since we're kind of fresh off arguably the biggest break in the case, I think that this case could see a solve one day. There will be some closure to figuring out how this letter connects back to a certain group, a certain organization, somebody who would have been employed to basically put a hit on this girl. And just to imagine, I don't know if anyone's actually talked to the real Angela, like the one who this letter was probably intended for, but talk about a lucky break.
Yeah.
Not getting picked out when you were the original target. That's insane. I mean, she may not have even known that. I'm sure she did, actually, because the letter came in 91. So I'm sure it was just private to their family. Like, by the way, there are people who are after you. You got to get out of town. We got to put you in witness protection.
It also kind of begs the question, though, like, why didn't they come forward when they got the letter?
The family?
Yeah.
I don't think that they made the connection. That's the problem. I think that this was, like, handled privately because he's a private informant. So him and his family were probably relocated for witness protection. And then they may have missed all of the news about whatever was going on with Angela Hammond.
Yeah. Or I guess, hello, the most obvious thing is, like, if he's an informant or isn't involved in something that's criminal, he's not going to come forward. But, like, how awful
also
to watch all this break down.
Seriously, what a tough job. Who can work that job to be an informant and someone who has a family? If you're an informant, you have to have no family, no pet, like, no liabilities, no pets, nothing.
Did you watch Ozark?
Did I? I'm sure I would remember if I did. I must have watched the first season and then, like, fell off.
Because I was going to say, only Jason Bateman and Laura Linney's characters could do it, I guess, with the family. And it turns out to be, you know, like, the whole point of it is just how evil is that to do that to your family and how ruthless you have to be.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Was he wasn't an informant, though. What was he doing in the Ozarks?
He was, I think, involved in like some sort of money laundering at the very beginning of, or no.
Oh, wait, you're right. Oh, yeah, God. He had to like get out of town, right? He had to disappear.
He was going to get killed. And then they say they actually let him go on the condition that he helps them launder money, I think, is what happened. I have to fact check myself. But then he begins to get involved. He like just gets more and more roped into everything and eventually kind of works his way up to becoming in cahoots with the like leader of this, and then kind of can't get himself out of it without hurting the people closest to him.
And why is Laura Linney just like bouncing around in this mix? Like, why did they involve the family? I guess they were just collateral.
Because, yeah, they were collateral. And also because Laura Linney's character is honestly more savvy and at the same time, like protective of her family. So I think she actually earns more respect than Jason Bateman's character does with the ringleader, because they can almost respect her level of like wanting to protect her own family. But at the same time, she's also extraordinarily bright. Whereas Jason Bateman's just kind of like, I'm going to do whatever it takes and be haphazard about whatever.
I'm going to have to rewatch it now. Now you got me intrigued. That was a great
I know. Now I'm like, I want to rewatch it after this. I know.
They need to be
too,
cutting you a check, honey.
I know. But not to be, you know, making light of this case with a fictional television show. But I mean, it does. It definitely like colors it for me in a different way.
Same here. And again, I mean, like I said, we have to take it all with a grain of salt because we don't have any substantial proof outside of that one phone call. But if you've got nothing to go on, anytime somebody gives you a lead, it's like you'll make a meal out of it. So
yeah,
I believe that this case could see something in the future. So I want to say that I have hope we'll revisit it down the line, maybe when we have more answers. But for now, that is where it stands. So, Stu, I'm going to say thank you for listening to this episode. Thank you to the Creepers for listening to this episode on Angela's story. And we're going to catch you guys on the next one. So for now, we're going to say goodbye.
And good luck, Creepers.
Bye, guys.
Bye.